it's a delight to chair this first session. It's actually the first session I chair since I arrived here at LSE a month ago. And it's on a topic that very much interests me. I followed very closely, of course, the formation of the banking union, and Cyprus came as a sort of premature test of the banking union, and I think one topic we'll have to discuss today, whether how it fared in that test. And also we know that it's a very imperfect banking union, where the supervision capacity is being built up as we speak, where the backstop is insufficient and needs a lot of tweaking probably to be satisfactory to countries that have the option to opt in. It's also a mechanism without deposit insurance. So the question is, would the Cyprus crisis have developed differently had there been a fully-fledged banking union? We will never get that answer, but at least a hypothetical question we can ask ourselves. Then, of course, there is a legacy of the banking crisis, with very high levels of non-performing loans, with individual institutions that need to be restructured. I had the pleasure in my previous life to see this from the inside, and Leo Kroska was here from EBRD, where I used to be, also probably can tell you quite a bit about the first investment the EBRD made, which was in the Bank of Cyprus, and how we learned both about the strengths and also about the weaknesses of the banking system in Cyprus. But without further ado, we have a terrific panel. Unfortunately, Daniel Gross has not arrived yet, so I will switch the order here and start with Alexander Michalidis, who is a professor of finance at Imperial College London. You speak for 15 minutes, and then we'll go with Elias Papagnou, who is from the London Business School. But please.
Thanks. Thank you. So this is a talk about something I wrote about that's come out in October 2014 in a journal called Economic Policy. And it's entitled Cyprus from Boom to Bail-in. The boom refers to two things that I'm going to talk about as I go in. The paper is available on my website, and it has a lot more detail on how things work. But I want to start by emphasizing the few things that were very unique and interesting about the Cyprus case. So in the resolution of the crisis, you can say a lot of first things that happened. So for the first time in the Eurozone, you had uninsured deposits that were used to recapitalize banks. For the first time, you had capital controls within the Eurozone, effectively devaluing euros in Cyprus. So Michalis Tsaris at the time said that the only safe euro is the euro in your pocket. So that's what this means. For the first time, the proposal to tax insured deposits was proposed in the Eurozone, and that was not ratified just because the Cypriot Parliament did not approve that tax, essentially. And also, for the first time, local politicians and well-respected commentators like Paul Krugman in the New York Times recommended that the best solution would be to quit the Eurozone, and that would be the best way to restart the economy in a small open economy case. So the question is, how do such dramatic events arise? And these are all big events. Now, in that paper, what I did, I kind of divided into two areas. One was the crisis prevention part, and the second part was crisis management. So for today, I'm going to focus on the crisis management part because I think it's a lot more relevant than to what's happening now in Cyprus, but also what's happening in Greece. That can maybe potentially useful lessons to learn from this experience. So if you're interested about the crisis prevention, there were a lot of things that went wrong in Cyprus, starting from the fiscal, the banking, the housing, external and credit imbalances, very high private credit growth. There were difficulties in cross-border banking supervision, you can use the Cyprus example as a reason for the existence of the banking union. The banking union is supposed to deal with these problems that exist in bankers trying to arbitrage either poor regulation or political interference in the banking system. So if you have a common banking union or a single supervisory mechanism, you can alleviate those problems. There were also issues with corporate and political governance. I'm going to emphasize the political governance in what follows. And then some European political decisions that you can argue were wrong, at least from the point of view of Cyprus. So I'm going to start with this diagram that I think quite well indicates what happened, basically, and what to expect. So this is the CDS spread. CDS spreads are basically insurance. You can basically interpret these lines when they go up as a higher probability of a country defaulting. And people pay these CDS spreads to buy this insurance. So when this goes up, it means either there's a high probability of a country defaulting and or when they default, you're not going to get anything for your money or you're going to get lower amount for your money back. And I have here the triangles are, and there's five countries in this, Cyprus, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain. The first one is when the country requested aid, and the circle is when the agreement was reached to actually bail out or bail in a country. The striking thing to note is that there's two things to note here. The one striking thing is that these four countries, which is Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain, essentially agreed this within 3 weeks, whereas Cyprus took Cyprus around 9 months to agree to reach an agreement. And then the other thing to note is that if you take this at face value, which there are some issues you need to deal with, some assumptions to make about the liquidity underlying this product, but you can argue that Cyprus should have asked for help in the summer of 2011, and that's when they should have done this, which is this line here, basically. If you kind of do a scientific straight line across these points, you can see that basically this is when they should have asked for help. Now, the question is, why did Cyprus ask for help so late, and what are the consequences of that delay in agreeing? So while... So the summer of 2011 is important for another reason. This is the unemployment rate in Cyprus, and you can see it basically going from around 8% to reaching close to 16%, so almost doubling in the period. This is from 2011 summer to until the agreement was reached in the March 2013. The unemployment rose quite a bit. The other unemployment is the euro area one that was rising and then came a bit down, and then you have the UK unemployment just because it's Cyprus' major trading partner in terms of tourism and potentially buying holiday homes. So Marie was the explosion in Cyprus in July 2011. So you can argue that the summer of 2011, when half of your electricity producing capacity was destroyed, you can argue that this was a time when something should have been done. At the time, the governor of the central bank said that this is like 1974. He was criticized for that because by some people because 1974 was a different scale of an event. On the other hand, you can argue that that would have been a good opportunity for somebody for politicians to actually take advantage of that and say, well, if this is the case, then we have to do something more urgent with the economy. Now, you can see, though, during this delay, the striking thing is this almost doubling of unemployment, which is a big, it implies, things getting a lot worse, both in the real economy, but also the banks that depend on problem loans. Now, at the same time, this is another striking graph, I think, which is the bank and non-bank deposit flows. So these are the deposits that exist in the banking sector from the banks to and also non-banks in Cyprus. So you can see that the initial request for bailout, this is starting from again July 2011, and it goes until the date of the bail-in. And the initial request for the bailout was the end of June 2012. So these are basically banks, financial institutions holding deposits in Cyprus, and this is households and corporates holding deposits in Cyprus. So what you can see is that these, and the numbers are basically 30 billion, and these 30 billion essentially from June 2012 went down to 20 billion in March 2013, which is basically a 10 billion outflow of deposits. And then you had a bit later, you know, you can argue that these are more sophisticated guys. So the more sophisticated people took their money out earlier, the less sophisticated people took them a while to figure it out. But then this was starting to a lesser degree, but it did increase quite a bit in the last few months after you started having a lot of talk in the press, in the Financial Times, in the Wall Street Journal. There was increasing talk after December about a potential bail-in. So even these guys started taking quite their money out. So then the question is, can you tell a story about this? So the question is, does information leak, and what are the implications? And therefore, what are the implications for in this issue about delay? So this is a paper that's coming out in this Journal of Financial Economics with some colleagues. I was at the University of Cyprus when we started this. And this is motivated, actually, by the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission in Cyprus in the summer of 2011, Mr. Haralambos at the time. So he one Saturday afternoon in August 2011, he came out on national television arguing that anybody who has information that should be made public should make it public. So it took me a while to figure out what he meant, what he had in mind, and what he actually... Because, you know, I was by the beach at the time. It was a Saturday night. I was wondering what was going on. So I started talking with these colleagues at the university, Andreas Milidonis and George Nishodis, and we figured out that he came out on Saturday to discuss this, and on Wednesday, Fitch downgraded the sovereign debt of Cyprus by 3 notches. Now, this is the cumulative daily raw return on the stock market, and this is date zero would be the event, let's say, when the public announcement was made. And you can see, like, if you start from a few days earlier, this is in days, so it starts from the, you know, the last 10 days, it basically the stock market dropped 30%. When the announcement was made, actually nothing really happened. And what he was referring to was the fact that this information actually leaks. So usually the way it works is the credit rating agencies come to the country, they talk with the government, with the central bank, they accumulate, they exchange views of what they're going to do, and then it becomes clear when it's a 3-notch downgrade especially that there's going to be a public release of this downgrade. And the point is that the information must have leaked. So we make and that's why the stock market fell basically before the public announcement. So we constructed a data set, and we made the point that in low quality institutional quality countries, this thing might happen. There might be information leakage that might destabilize the stock market. Now, why is this relevant here? It's relevant because there is a cost of this. You have delay in reaching an agreement, and you have. You have information leaking for various reasons, either because people talk too much or because they want to trade on the information. It could be legal or illegal. It could be inadvertent. It could be not inadvertent. So you can, whatever story you pick, the point is that this information leaks and you have a delay. So that can make things a lot worse. So what was the cost of this delay in the presence of this information leaking? One is the increase in this emergency liquidity assistance, which basically implies a higher cost in the banking system, and it's really a major determinant of the final resolution in the sense that the ECB had to get its money. So from the point of view of having this liability, to a large degree, it became the major problem in reaching an agreement, and the major determinant of what type of an agreement you're going to reach, because the ELA is an important thing, and the ECB will go after people who are not going to repay, which remains an issue, especially in a country like Greece. Then at the same time, you have, during the delay, you have a worsening budget deficit. The market typically doesn't move at all. You have the uncertainty, which is the other issue that is relevant right now. If you have uncertainty whether you're going to stay in the euro or not, or uncertainty when you're going to reach an agreement, means a worsening recession. You also had worsening bank capital needs as time was going by, especially because European political decisions required higher capital to be held by the banks. You had some bailout fatigue, which basically can generate less patience with people who are delaying. And then you have the whole interaction. You had an interaction between banks getting worse. You had the sovereign debt the spreads rising. And that loop is a loop that is quite relevant. And you cannot treat them one separate from the other. You have sovereign debt problems that feed on the banking and then back to the sovereign and back to the economy, and that magnifies the problems get worse. So you cannot separate one from the other. You have to have they're both determined together in equilibrium in these things, and they do get worse as time goes by. So the main point from this is that the cost of delay can be quite high. There is no paper actually that models quantifies all of these things together and how you can evaluate within a model all of these interactions and come up with good estimates. But the intuition from these graphs is that economic problems need to be fixed earlier rather than later. So deferring things can be quite costly, and the resolution at the end might be quite bad. In this paper, I also have this point of overconfidence. So I think one of the issues with delaying is that Cyprus grew for many. So I have a graph on the real GDP growth of Cyprus after 1980 until 2010. You can have an average of 3 to 4% real GDP growth per year. Politicians growing up in these regime kind of might think that a delay by 1 year might not be a big thing, given that how well Cyprus has done in the past. What can happen to the smart Cypriots, let's say. But this overconfidence can really be quite another reason of why this delay was deemed to be not so costly. And I want to emphasize the resemblance of this situation with what's currently happening, both in Greece but also in Cyprus. So. In Cyprus, there's a delay in this fifth Troika agreement to be this evaluation of the package, because these laws that have not passed, and these laws, it's not obvious. You need to make a decision. They might be hard laws, but you need to make a decision and get on with it. Otherwise, delaying is not a way to solve the problem, essentially. And Greece has the same feature in the sense that. I feel that they have lost 6 months from the current in the current situation, and delaying the kind of the inevitable that they will have to get a deal at some point. And this uncertainty and delay basically worsens both the budget and the bank situation, which is kind of almost the same thing that happened in Cyprus.
Thank you very much. Now, Daniel has arrived, and Daniel Gross from the Center for Economic Policy Studies in Brussels. Please, Daniel.
Thanks a lot. My arriving late illustrates one economic principle, that there's a difference between ex ante and ex post decisions.
Yes.
When you arrive at the train station, you have a choice between taking the tube.
Yes.
Which might be slower but more reliable, or taking a taxi, that's a high variance affair. And I went for the low variance approach, but it was a bit longer than I had expected, and I apologize for getting up the water. There we are. Okay. Previous speaker has concentrated very much on one aspect of the Cypriotic affair, which was the delay in the decision, which is, as he rightly emphasized, always very costly. I wanted to emphasize more the broader picture and the lessons learned, or what you can see in Cyprus in relation to the banking union, which we have, and here I must say, over on the continent, which is in the process of becoming operative. And I would say that Cyprus here provides us with two very important lessons or insights. First one is that we have an inherent instability if you have a monetary union without a banking union. And that by itself is a very vast topic, so we'll just concentrate on one or two aspects of that. And the second point is that banking resolution is very regime specific. You can write as many rules as you want about how resolution should happen. In the end, the decision is mostly guided by the specific political economic circumstances of the moment, and I would emphasize more the political than the economic circumstances, than the economic circumstances. And I think Cyprus, again, is an illustration of that. Now, in thinking about Cyprus in relationship also with the other bailout countries, sometimes I think about the inverse of the Anna-Karenina principle, right? You know, all happy families are alike, all unhappy ones are unhappy in their own ways. Now, all bailout countries are alike, at least before they enter the bailout, in the sense that they all have a large current account deficit. If you rely on large capital inflows, as long as the sun shines and you're on the beach, things are nice, and then, as we all know, as economists, when things turn around, you have a crisis, and you can find yourself in a very ugly situation very, very quickly. Ireland, Spain, Portugal, and Greece, and Baltic countries, Iceland, whatever your exchange rate regime, whatever your size, except if you're in the United States, if you rely on very large capital inflows, you are in danger. And I think Cyprus was no exception to that. I think the current account was at its peak 15% of GDP, which is normally already, I mean, such a big red warning sign that you should immediately take action. But is that in Cyprus you had, on top of that, an additional element, namely the foreign adventures of the local banking system. A bit like the Icelandic banks, but different, because it was again all mixed up in a difficult political and supervisory environment where your banks invest in the bonds of a neighboring country, which is politically important, which is politically connected, and the potential for trouble is endless. So that was, I think, the situation ex ante. Let me see whether this one works now.
No.
Ah, this one, it is nice. Okay, great. Okay, thanks. And the second point was, I think, the failure of course, as we already alluded to, supervision, which was national. As I come back later to that, that is one of the big aspects which will change with the banking union. What happens if you have a national supervisor who sees his or her own banks growing smartly because they're offering high deposits? High deposit rates. Ah, these guys are very smart, they're doing big business. We are becoming a financial center. Right? Unless these bankers are particularly smart, as they thought they were in Iceland, right? We know that this cannot go on for a very long time. Higher deposit rates are always a sign of trouble, looming trouble ahead. High meaning substantially higher than offered in similar countries or in similar circumstances by other banks. because that's the typical business model of such a bank is we attract high deposits, we invest in risky assets, or assets whose riskiness is not perceived by us. And then if things go well, we cash in. If things go badly, somebody else has to pay. Right? In this case, whoever is responsible for the banks. Now, under a national regime, it's the national taxpayer who has to pay. In future, it will be the European taxpayer or the European bank client who will have to pay. And of course, that makes this, the game then a little bit different. As I said earlier, the Icelandic banks did the same. They also collected deposits in Germany, UK, and elsewhere, offering 2 or 3 percentage points more than everybody else on internet accounts, and thought, we are so smart, we take that money, invest it in buildings in London, in a bank in Denmark or elsewhere, and that's how we make our profits. Okay, and then comes the downturn and you're stuck. In the case of Cyprus, banks invested in Greek government bonds, which by regulation were riskless. Okay, so supervisor says, what's the problem? Of course, the reality was that they were risky. And then they had subsidiaries in Greece, which were sold back and forth at, say, politically influenced prices to make matters worse and increase the potential for bickering between the parts, who paid the right price, who was just, and so on. So this was really a morass which was very, very dangerous. So the one picture perhaps you should retain is this one here. Here, the uppermost line, you see the household deposit rates in Cyprus. And I've put you here some of the other countries in trouble, Italy, Portugal, and Germany, of course, as a benchmark, so to speak. And what immediately should make you suspicious is this nice horizontal line for Cyprus, which is above everybody else. Right? That was a sign of trouble. And I must say, when I look at the tail end, very much to right, somehow the trouble seems to continue. Why would banks in Cyprus pay markedly higher deposit rates than everybody else? Have they found a business model where they can achieve higher returns than other people? These were the questions that should have been asked, right? And apparently they were not. And I think this picture was behind the decision then of the Northern Europeans to say, okay, we need to bail in somebody down there, right? Because people who invest and at rates markedly higher than, let's say, normal, similar circumstances, they should have known that they were taking a risk. So some bail-in should be appropriate. I won't talk about the first decision to try to bail in insured deposits, but you can imagine what people were thinking, saying, 6 or 7 years of 3% more, maybe we can ask them for a solidarity contribution. Right? That was the implicit reasoning behind that. Whether it was equitable or not, we can discuss. But this is, I think, the key point you should keep in mind. Now, the interesting question then is, what would have happened to Cyprus under a banking union regime? And there are two questions you should really ask. Could the Cypriot case arise under banking union? Right? And the second is, if it had arisen anyway, how would we have dealt with under banking union? Now, in reality, the problem should not have arisen in the first place because here a bit jargon, SSM is a single supervisory mechanism. Read basically ECB for that, right? The ECB is now a two-armed or two-legged monster. One leg does monetary policy and the other leg does banking supervision. And the two actually they're joined at the top, but with a Chinese wall in the top, so one part is not supposed to know what the other part is doing, right? That's the theory. So a supervisor sitting in Frankfurt, let me see, looking at this data sometime beforehand, would have said, there's something fishy going on here. Let me take a closer look. And probably would have intervened much earlier. Then the national supervisor always thinks the bigger my banks, the better. So in that sense, I think something would have happened much earlier, and the problem would not have arisen, at least at the same scale as it arose later, with this oversized banking system. Now, once you were in that type of situation with these banks having attracted lots of deposits, promising high deposit rates, and then having to invest in high-yielding assets, and the closest high-yielding asset were Greek assets, right? Once they had done that, then you had an inherent conflict between the two arms of this two-armed monster in Frankfurt, namely between the one-armed SSM, which is a single supervisor mechanism, meaning those who supervise the banks, and what I call the Euro system, mainly the part which does monetary policy. The SSM takes the micro view, regulatory view, looks at the books and says, what assets do you have? Government bonds. I look at my rule book, they are riskless, no problem. Right? That they are Greek government bonds, okay, so be it, but I have to apply my rule book which says government bonds are riskless. Right? Whatever. Go on, be happy. And then there's, of course, the other side, the Eurosystem side, which looks at the overall macroeconomic situation and says and thinks it's catastrophic, huge current account deficit, sudden stop, country needs to adjust, banks are going to be in trouble. And we also know that Greece is very much in trouble since we're in the Troika there. So this stuff should be stopped. Right? And you can see how this potential conflict within the ECB could arise. It's also potential for maximizing information flow. When the ECB had to give or had approved ELA, emergency liquidity assistance to Cypriotic banks, it didn't really know the situation of the banks. It didn't have access to supervisor detailed information for one simple reason, which is that supervisor information is always detailed client information, and it's confidential. So nobody in Cyprus actually was allowed to tell the guys at the ECB what the true situation of the Cypriotic banks was. So they were like kind of in the dark, right? And therefore, that was of course very difficult for the ECB to act. Okay, let me be very brief on the second point which I wanted to make, which is bank resolution is always very circumstantial. If you're in the midst of a financial crisis, everybody inside will be bailed out, right? You have seen Lehman, the next week you bail out AIG, you bail out anybody else who's in trouble, right? But then things evolve, right? And especially then those who have to take the decision, they look at the perceived risk of other people getting nervous in the financial markets. So what matters is the risk appetite in the end in the financial market. And the second point is, of course, the feeling, the political feeling. If you bail in somebody, is that somebody who is politically important? And you're sitting in Berlin or in Brussels, a depositor in a Cypriotic bank is not particularly politically relevant. And especially if you think that a large part of them are Russians, then you say, okay, why not? Right? So you always have this combination of political and economic. At the time when it happened, it was really not a foregone conclusion. There were big discussions because financial market people came to all the decision makers and said, if you bail in depositors, all hell will break loose. We'll have a bank run all over the Eurozone. Right? Of course, they spoke their book. And the policymakers did take the risk, and it turned out that markets was able to take it. In future, I would say the legal text will become more important because of the remoteness of the decision makers. The guys who will take the decision will no longer be national. They will be the guys in the what's called the Single Resolution Fund, 200 people will take part in the decision, but in the end, there will be a few who will take the decision. And they're very much more remote from the local people who might be bailed in or not. And therefore, I think bail-in, which will soon be mandatory under the legal texts that we have approved in the EU, will become more frequent. And that leads me to the one missing element, which everybody knows about banking union. It is that, as we see in Cyprus, you bail in the depositors, but somebody has to bail out the insured depositors. Bailout has to pay for them. And that, as things stand, is a national deposit guarantee system, which means a big burden on the government if you have a large banks and have a systemic banking crisis at home. So I would say my conclusion is, if you're a small country, it's better not to have a too large a banking system, especially not one concentrated on one particular business model, even under the banking union. The banking union provides you with some partial protection, but that's it. So I would conclude by saying Cyprus is a special case. The question which was posed in the title of the session here, whether that is an effective and equitable model, the one that was applied to Cyprus, I don't think it was a model. It was a decision sui generis. As I said, if you're a small country with a large banking sector, either you're Switzerland, you have a super strong external accounts and super strong fiscal accounts, or if you're Iceland, you have to basically cut loose your foreign activities and hide behind capital controls at home. In the EU, that's a bit more difficult, right? And finally, if you want to have large banks, please make sure that they're owned by foreigners, foreigners with deep pockets, right? That is very useful. That's how the Baltic countries survived. Their banks were 90%, except for one case, Latvia, were owned by Swedish banks, and given the strength of the Swedish economy, the Swedish supervisor, and the Swedish government's deep pockets, they were able to survive because they didn't have to pay for all these the losses which these banks experienced at home themselves. Right? They went, as I was told, the Estonians sent over a delegation every week to talk to the Swedish authorities, saying, please, please continue. don't let our banking systems fall. And they didn't do that, and that's how the Baltics came through the crisis rather well. So I would say we'll have a banking union in Europe, which provides partial protection. Even with small countries, you can have a larger banking sector, but I would still recommend that don't keep it in domestic hands. Thank you very much.
And the final speaker is Elias Papaniou.
So I would like to thank Elias and the organizers for inviting me here. So the topic of this session is understanding the bail-in. Since there are many experts on the Cypriot banking system, both in the panel and also on the floor, I resisted the temptation of many economists to talk about things that I don't know very well, which is something that inherently happens more and more often. So I decided a bit to focus how we can understand the crisis much more general, both in Cyprus and also in Greece, where I know a bit more of the details, and more generally in Europe. And I want to start, this is actually our initial discussion with Elias Dinenis when he asked me to contribute to this session. So I had done some work initially on optimum currency areas and how we can understand Europe. This was done before the crisis, based on this idea that, which actually has its origin in the 50s and the 60s, when there was a very fierce debate on whether we should move to very flexible exchange rates, this was the view of Milton Friedman, or whether we should peg, we should have like fixed exchange rate regime. And at the time, Bob Mundell, McKinnon, Peter Kennan came up with this idea that, wait a minute, we can have some cases where we should proceed and we should use the same currency, let's say the Cypriots, the Germans, and the Greeks, or in some other cases, this is not desirable. And the so-called classical optimum currency area criteria of Mundell actually stress some features which are all economic. So if there is labor mobility, then it's good because the economies can buffer asymmetric shocks. It's good if the economies are relatively open because it will allow them to smooth consumption. So the idea there was that let's detail some economic situations that will give us, if you like, a checklist on when we should proceed together. Now, the critical, I think, for me, option is that all of these features were economic in nature. And the so-called modern optimum currency area theory, which is currently under development by my friends Emmanuel Farhi and Ivan Vernick and their co-authors in the US, actually, they elaborate on the Mandelian view. They introduce Keynesian frictions such as potentially isolation or the presence of liquidity constraints, price or wage stickiness, and see how this can alter the initial insights. My problem, before I detail my problem, let me stress that here politicians, in the 90s at least, European Union politicians, they were decisive. And I think this was a plus. So they ignored the debate. At the time, Martin Feldstein was writing about potential wars in Europe. My advisor, Richard Portes, was writing that the euro would be a blessing. You know, the European policymakers at some point in the 90s, they said, you know, let's forget those crazy academics. Let's proceed. European monetary unification has to be a part of the united Europe. And I think this was a plus. What I consider to be a minus is that at the time there was not a very good understanding, nor was the desire to learn, what would be the implications looking into the future. And the Maastricht Treaty criteria, which are like famous or infamous, actually they all detailed like a set of four or five criteria, such as the public debt ceiling of approximately 60%, a fiscal deficit that should not exceed 3%, very low levels of inflation, and some macroeconomic stability. Now, the issue which I think actually set the seed of the origins of the problems that we observe today is that, one, all of those criteria were outcomes. So for a political economist like me, when you see about the GDP growth, immediately I want to explain it with something. When I see high levels of public debt, I want to explain this feature. The Maastricht criteria said that, you know, the Greeks should have the same level of public debt as some countries in the north, neglecting why Greece had such high levels of debt to start. At the same time, I must admit, and actually it's nice that my presentation follows Dan's, who focused a lot on laws and supervision and monitoring looking into the future, but so far at least, and I'm referring both to the 90s and the Belle Epoque period, let me call that the 2007-2008 period, enforcement was very lax on this criteria. And it was lax both for the countries of the south, the periphery, and also for the countries of the north. So to me, the fundamental problem, this is what I want to mostly discuss, is that the Maastricht criteria, or if I was to be critical to my discipline, economics, we all focused on growth, on debt, on deficit, on inflation, on wage inflation, while all of these features are endogenous outcomes. And what are the features that drive economic policy? At some level, they are politics. At some level, perhaps deeper, are institutions. And actually, institutions themselves do not fall as manna from the sky. They are also endogenous to what people believe, what are the cultural and historical traits of different countries. And this is what I want to mostly focus on today. So, and this problem of focusing on economic outcomes and perceiving them to be like the origins, if you like, of the crisis, it was a consistent mistake of European policymakers. It was a mistake done in the 90s during the convergence period. It was a problem during the Belle Epoque, the early 2000s. It is a problem even as we speak with the Troika's program, or since I'm Greek, the institutions, as we have recalled it. Which again tells you something that I want to stress, which is about some deeper cultural traits. So what are the implications of this myopic, if you like, view on focusing on economic outcomes First of all, you have had many cases of mistakes, and actually back-to-back mistakes, both from the political establishment of the countries that implemented adjustment programs, but also from the Troika or the institutions, if you prefer. You had a massive deterioration of popular support, and here as a Greek I want to stress that as of May-June 2010, when the Greek administration at the time signed the first adjustment program with the Troika, the popularity of the IMF in Greece was staggering. It was very, very high. It deteriorated in a period of less than 2 years. Why? Because I think the program lacked legitimacy. People could not feel that they were owners of the reform. And why was that? Because, again, the program focused on, it focused mostly on economic, if you like, outcomes, rather than the deep features that determine those outcomes. So let me tell you what, the Troika's initial view. In the case of Greece, I presume also in the case of Cyprus, unit labor costs. So I used to work at the ECB at the time, in 2005-2007. At the time, the ECB was obsessed with a high level of wage inflation in Greece. I'm not saying this was, they should have been obsessed. But this was a bit of a myopic view because it ignored why on earth wage inflation in Greece was so high as compared to Germany or some other countries in the European Union. The other favorable number of the Troika or the EU more generally before, public debt. Huge differences on the stock of public debt. I'm referring at the beginning of the crisis, Greece and Italy having debt to GDP ratios of approximately 120% of GDP, some of the Baltic countries very low levels of GDP, of debt to GDP. Fiscal position, actually, Cyprus is a very good case. Cyprus enters the crisis with a fiscal surplus, if anything, so they were actually very prudent. It seems that the government a bit screwed up just before the crisis. In contrast, the Greek government is with a huge fiscal deficit. Now, the current account, it was, and this is something that Daniel mentioned, which illustrates the lack of productivity or the lack of competitiveness on the international market, was, here I plot to you some statistics on the PIGS countries. It was a statistic that the Troika and the International Observer started looking at a later stage of the crisis. In the beginning, they myopically viewed the problem as being purely fiscal in nature. Now, here are, if you like, my critique to the approach taken by politicians, both at the European level and also at the local level, and what I think it makes us illustrate and understand the crisis. Let's take the case of a fiscal deficit. Why on earth you can have a fiscal deficit? At least in the stupid economics model that I write, you can have one way, which is, if you like, as a Keynesian way, if you like, to stimulate demand when things turn badly. So let's say this is what the Bush and the Obama administration did, or the Gordon Brown administration did in 2007-2008. Or you could have a case like Greece, where consistently you were running high deficits. On Monday I taught a case at London Business School in Argentina. They consistently run fiscal deficits. The two, you know, the numbers might look the same, so you might look like the US has a debt to a deficit of, let's say, 10 percentage points of GDP, which would be the same as Greece or Argentina, but they are not the same thing. In the sense that in the US or in the UK, it was a rational choice of policymakers to respond to a crisis, for good or bad. But in the case of Greece or many other countries in the periphery, it was like a structural problem. In the case of Argentina, it reflects populist policies. An alternative, let me focus on something else. Inflation and wage differentials. You could say that one country has relatively high levels of price and wage inflation just because it's experiencing a productivity boom. But you can have high levels of inflation because product markets are super regulated, there are numerous barriers to fair entry, and the product markets are very uncompetitive. So the way the EU designed convergence and monitoring post the introduction of the euro was that we don't care, we just focus on inflation, ignoring why we observe inflation, both on prices and wages. So some neglected facts, which someone doing research in institutions and development, actually it's very surprising, is that if you focus on the convergence period and the initial early 2000 period, there was no discussion at all about the significant differences on institutional performance across the EU. You had like some countries where red tape was minimal. To obtain a license to start up a business, it was a like straightforward thing to do. And then you had cases like Greece where you had to like go over a gazillion of local administrators to get those licenses. Legal quality, many, many differences. And to me, it was crucial because the numbers that you saw earlier, the high stock of Greek debt, actually it's an outcome of those institutional deficiencies. It was not a random event that Greece, or if you like, Italy, entered the crisis with a high stock of public debt, as compared to some countries in the north where this was not the case. And looking more general, looking deeper, so all this literature, the academic literature on institutions and development, has been criticized for good, that institutions themselves are not random events, and they reflect what people believe, with their views about the world, their interactions with their peers, both inside the country and outside. And I just want to show you some statistics on that. So this graph, for example, comes from the European Social Survey. It's based on a speech I gave last year to some EU politicians. And it gives you an indication of how people trust, whether you trust a stranger or not. The interesting aspect here is that you see like Cyprus, Portugal, Greece, you know, those people before the crisis, they were trusting way, way less other people. There is also some very cool research by Luigi Guizzo, Paolo Sapienza, and Luigi Zingales, showing that actually bilateral trust was very huge before the crash, actually before the inception of the euro in the late 90s. So you were asking the Greeks, do you trust the Italians? And they would say, no, we don't trust them. Actually, so you had like this phenomenal thing, and of course the Germans were not trusting the Italians, and so it's a very nice bilateral matrix. Do you believe that people, so that's another question from the European Social Survey, do you believe that people are trying to get advantage of it? You know, this, I mean, if you are Greek, you are not surprised that much. But actually, I was surprised a bit by the numbers from Cyprus. In Cyprus, people believe that, you know, strangers want to take advantage of them. Look also at the numbers for Greece. Again, a huge, if you like, cultural divide. So then one could say, let me give you something now you may have said, why do these features are relevant? Let me tell you one feature that for sure is relevant. Greece became notorious sometime in 2011, where in the island it was revealed that something like 300,000 individuals were getting disability or social security allowance without having a merit. And there was a famous case of the island of Zakynthos, where apparently a third of the population were blind, and they were getting like a blindness allowance. Now, actually, these statistics come from some super cool work of Jan Algan and Pierre Cahoud, and they are based on the late 90s, so well before the crisis. And here comes to me what is very interesting. In Greece, people believe that it is okay if I get a disability allowance while, you know, I can stand up and give a crash speech. While in some other countries, like in the north, in the Netherlands, actually people believe that, you know, it's not legit to claim for a disability allowance while you do not get it. So it should not be as a huge surprise that clearly in the island of Zakynthos or in many other small communities in Greece, everybody was part of the problem. Everybody knew, but for them it was legit to do so. Now, does it matter? Well, there is a very interesting line of research showing that trust and income, which is the scatter plot on the left, or civicness, or civic capital and income, correlate quite strongly. It correlates. So here I'm just giving you three scatter plots focusing on high-income countries, so in an effort to control apples with apples. So these are like the EU countries. These measures of trust, or whether you perceive the others are fair or unfair, it's a feature of educated societies, of societies that do innovation, of societies that do well. Even if you focus within countries and compare regions within countries, which is some cool work of Guido Tabellini, you still tend to find some similar positive associations in the data. So here comes, and I want to illustrate one of my key arguments here. A problem in Greece is the pervasive and decentralized nature of corruption. So to get a permit, you need to go over many, many public agencies, and, you know, in small cases you have to bribe each of them, or, you know, not necessarily each of them, but there is a game there. And of course, if you want to go with a very big plant infrastructure, then it becomes even harder. Now, the view of the Troika or the view of the Greek administration has been, okay, let's try to solve this problem with some legal ways or, you know, some administrative ways. Let me say up front that this is a good starting point. But why on earth Greece has such high levels of red tape, and many other countries, by the way, and some other countries do not? And here, let me give you a story which Philippa Guion, Andrei Schleifer, and their co-authors have very eloquently modeled. In Greece, based on the data I showed you earlier, and also in Cyprus from what I hear, the average person distrusts the entrepreneur. He believes that the entrepreneur is not there to contribute with his skills and talents, create new jobs, make money in a capitalist system, but he believes that the competent entrepreneur is the one who manages to get around the system of many licenses, who is very good at dealing with the government, obtaining the necessary permits, so he's not particularly competent. So let's say that people believe that, and as I showed you some numbers, actually people, there are huge differences on that. So what would voters and the political system that represents voters decide? Okay, we distrust the entrepreneur. My friend Vasilis here, you know, is distrusted in Greece. So what will all the Greeks do? Okay, let's make him obey with every freaking regulation that we could think of. Then, you know, there are many people, so let's say, you know, Elias and Vasilis compete, but then eventually Elias is the one who manages to get all those permits, you know, through bribes and corruptions. So what will each of us observe? Who is the successful entrepreneur? Elias, but not necessarily because he's the brightest, but because he was very, very good at playing this game. So the prior becomes endogenously verified. So what? So you have this amazing paradox that although you realize the problem, you want even more regulation because Elias managed to find the loophole. So now I want to close the loophole. And as Daniel mentioned earlier, very eloquently the case of banking, there is never going to be like a law that will dictate every possible situation that will occur. So, to sum up, and I'll have the last slide as a teaser, I think that a way to understand the crisis, it has to go, we have to dig deeper and not myopically study economics. The convergence criteria or the targets of the Troika or the institutions, if you prefer, focus on economic outcomes. Outcomes, those economic outcomes are a function of the institutions in place, which are slow moving at best, and of the norms and the values and the beliefs of people, which differ considerably across countries, say, inside the European Union. So I think that it is crucial for both for the crisis hit country, but also for Europe as a whole moving forward, to a bit tackle this issue and not tackle the symptom, try to dig a bit deeper and tackle the causes, if you like, of the problem, which in my view has to do with institutional differences and massive differences on values and beliefs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we had, by serendipity, we had a very nice sequence of speeches. So Alexander spoke about, you know, why it's costly to wait and try to explain a bit the factors why it took some time. Daniel talked about had we had the banking union, things would have been different, but you know, there are still very many missing features that would be necessary to make it work fully, and that Cyprus had, you know, some specific features that made it maybe not a good model. And Elias spoke about how beliefs shape corruption, how it affects attitude towards entrepreneur, and how that affected the crisis. So I think this was a very nice, and not the intended row of speakers, but it worked out very well. Now I want to get the floor a chance to come in. Please identify yourself.
Bernard Casey from University of Warwick and Hellenic Observatory here. One of the things which I was interested in, it's to do with administrative capacity. Cyprus always had a sort of patina of the remainder of British colonialism. It was
Yeah, okay. Let's collect a few.
That's right. Well, mine follows nicely from Bernard's. Kevin Featherstone from the Hellenic Observatory. I took from Elias's description that quality of governance, institutions, culture matters. But for my own purposes, I've been looking at some of the World Bank indicators of world governance indicators for the World Bank. And of course, over something like a 20-year period, they show differences between EU members being remarkably stable. So the obvious question is that if institutions and culture should be brought into the equation in a much more substantive fashion, why should we be optimistic that we can change these things? And how indeed could the European Union help to change the divergences in quality of governance at the domestic level?
Let's take one more and then we...
Kyriako Tsoupras, Cypriot journalist. The question is to Mr. Gross, the other members of the panel can deal with it, because speaking about the high deposit rates, you ask yourself if things go well and if things go bad. My question is, could they go well, having in mind that money was going to Cyprus from everywhere, really, and the market for lending was so limited, even if you take into account Greece and some other places?
Okay, so I'll take these three questions, then take another round. So who wants to come in? There was a question for you.
One is this issue with the high deposit rates, actually. So one of the problems in Cyprus, which is related also to this administrative capacity idea, is that data is not very good, actually. So there is this perception that deposit rates were high, and they were high for certain deposits that were held for certain periods of time. But if you talk to a lot of the people who are doing the, if you talk to the accountants, they will tell you that, you know, all the tax structures that exist in Cyprus is actually things that were very high frequency money that they used to come in Cyprus and leave the next month to go pay their account somewhere else. So finding the right data for this is not very easy. So for example, if you try to do a weighted average of this deposit rate by maturity, let's say, of these deposits, it's not very easy to actually do. Even the ones, the data that I showed you about the deposits, they come from the ECB website that has these things. But if you try to match it with the data that exists on the Central Bank website, the Central Bank website of Cyprus has this publicly available data that they're supposed to be the same, but they split it up by residency status. Now, how do you split the residency status between domestic, foreign, all these tax structures, who is the resident and who is the non-resident and who is the EU and who is the non, is a very difficult thing and it's not done well, actually. And then you also have the maturity issue. So I want to set it as a question that, you know, just showing the deposit rate on some deposits that were high, it's not obvious that it reflects the main problem of the country. I do not deny that the bankers took risks and they took risks intentionally. And there's a paper that's coming out also in this JFE paper that a lot of European bankers did it by Achari and Stefan, where they say the greatest carry trade ever, which is this trade that you pay on the regulatory stuff, that the risk, you know, the risk weighting of these bonds is zero, they're risk-free, and therefore you take the yield, but then you have the risk. So people did that in Cyprus, and they should have been prevented from doing that potentially. But it's not obvious, to my mind at least, having looked at this, that this deposit thing is right. And this goes back to the administrative capacity. You would think that this is a simple thing to do, but it's not. So there is this wide perception in Cyprus that data should be kept secret somehow. And it either reflects, many times, it either reflects corruption or incompetence. I'm actually more of the sympathetic kind, and I think it's incompetence usually. You know, if you don't give the data, nobody will ask you any questions. It hides your incompetence very, very much. So that's why right now we don't have good data on how many of the of the people are strategically defaulting, let's say. Even the central bank doesn't have that data, which shows you that the administrative capacity might not be as strong as the one you might think. It's related to that. And my sense, without having any evidence, is that institutionally, as you move away from the 1960s, you are more becoming, there is a lot of new laws that have entered that have been influenced actually by the Greek state as opposed to by the English state. So at some point in the 80s, a lot of the legal issues started to be done in Greek as opposed to in English. So you have this gradual erosion of the English influence and more, you know, towards the continental, if you prefer, or Greek. But then there's no hard data evidence for that to be supported. I mean, something to be looked into more.
Daniel, was the right question for you.
Yeah, on the deposit rates, well, I think the data is actually pretty good, but that we can discuss. The basic point is simple. If you are in a small island in the Mediterranean and you want to attract deposits, if you don't pay above market, and substantially above market mean other countries, you don't attract them. So the deposit rates must have been high enough to attract.
No. There's a tax benefit. There's a tax benefit when you subtract.
But you have the tax. Sorry. The tax on deposits is in Italy, for example, 15%. Right? Whether you pay on 2% rate, 15%. Right?
It's on 0.3. It's a tax on profits.
It's not. That's something. Anyway. You don't have to keep your money where you have. Okay, that's we get into deep water, but it's quite clear. You have to attract, if you want to have massive deposits from abroad, you have to attract them with something, right? With some implicit promise of having a higher rate of return. And that can work for a while, but it cannot work forever, under no circumstance. When it goes bust, usually the thing which make it go wrong, you say, that's the fault of. So the Icelanders went for 15 years with a nice investment boom abroad. I said, it wasn't our fault, just because the world market fell down and therefore we made losses. Right? In Cyprus, you would say just because the Greek made losses. But it's the same story everywhere, right? If you attract high deposits, if you want to attract lots of deposits from abroad, you have to offer implicitly some higher rates of return. Allow me one comment on the institutions and the institutional quality. And I've looked at the same data, and that would be my question also to you. If these institutional factors and the beliefs are so slow moving and apparently impervious to outside interference, what can you do? And the EU as such can, by construction, do almost nothing. Because the EU is based on a compact between sovereign countries, initially of a perceived similar quality of governance. So the assumption was, if something is decided in Brussels, it's never decided in detail. It's what's called a directive, a general rule, and has to be implemented at the national level. Right? As you know, the famous bureaucracy in Brussels has fewer employees than the city of Brussels. We cannot run the detail of the public administration in any member countries from Brussels. But I want to add one caveat to what you said, that these differences across member countries are constant. They are constant, but there are some countries which are improving and some countries which are deteriorating. The ones which are improving are typically, for example, the Baltics, where you have a conscious effort. For example, Estonia, in terms of the indicator of corruption, started below Greece and has now moved up. As I said earlier, but there are only two countries which I have, I don't know, in the European Union, where there have been large changes over the last 10 years. In these corruption indicators. And there has been a large deterioration. And these two countries are Italy and Greece. Right? So
generally beyond corruption as well.
Beyond, exactly. It just corruption and others. Yeah. So the Italy and the Greece of 10, 15 years ago was different from the one that we have today. And the key question I would have is, why did it happen in some countries, in these two particular, and not in others?
Yes, so if I'm allowed to answer your questions. So, first of all, exactly as Daniel mentioned, what is really interesting in the case of Greece and a couple of other countries, not only Italy, is that in the booming years, so those corruption and general institutional quality indicators, they are criticized for good as being reflecting development. So many people will tell you, look, you should not use these measures because they are outcomes of development. But in Greece, you have like this immense boom, and at the same time, you have deterioration on those institutional quality indicators. And personally, I don't like that much the corruption indicators, but the doing business indicators, the court system. It was becoming worse and worse in Greece over time. Obtain necessary licenses to start up a business. It was hard to start with. It was becoming harder and harder and harder. So this indicates on the positive side that you can change those things. They are slow moving over time, but they change in Greece for sure over the past 10 years. So perhaps you can revert this trend. Secondly, on state capacity, because I think this is the key issue, at least in the case of Greece. It is something that the IMF explicitly acknowledged in their assessment report as of June 2014, that they underestimated the capacity of the Greek state. It is also a mistake that the Greek political system made. And this has contributed massively not only to the failure of the program, but to the lack also of legitimacy. Because in the case of Greece, you had this paranoia, which was the following. The Troika and the government passing legislation saying increasing taxation on real estate and saying that in theory we should be collecting 4.5 billion, but we will raise 3 because of improper enforcement. None of this. So this policy, I think that in Greece there should have been a real estate tax. But what tells you for the legitimacy of this reform that you are institutionalizing measures to collect 4.5 and at the end you collect 3. So state capacity is something that I think it was a mistake of the Troika and the Greek administration that there was not a big assistance. Because at least in the case of Greece that I'm aware of, initially the Troika had the view, okay, I want to narrow the deficit. I don't care how you collect taxes. I don't go into the nitty-gritty of stuff. And I think this was a huge mistake because in the beginning, one reason why the program was very popular, in Greece at least, it was because the Greeks thought that they would get technical assistance from the Germans, from the Belgians, from the other European peers on how to tackle those issues. On the issue of corruption, which I think is crucial, and that's why I don't like the World Bank measures, actually what matters a lot, and this is a lot of economics argument on that, is also the structure of corruption. And here for the economic geeks, I refer to a fantastic paper of Bob Wissen and Andrei Schleifer in 1994, making the following point. Compare Greece today, where you have a very decentralized system of corruption and need to bribe many, many agencies, and compare that to Suharto. In the case of Suharto, where corruption was very centralized, I can think of Suharto as a monopolist. There is a deadweight loss. Clearly, it's inefficient, but that's the best way to think about corruption in East Asia at the time, when East Asia was doing well. In their application, I think they compare some transition countries, but actually Greece is a very good case. It's a totally different system when I have corruption, where you know I have to bribe many, many people for complementary services. Each agent is a local monopolist, because in order to operate, I need 20 different licenses. So this makes the problem much harder. So the deadweight loss is way higher, and at the same time, it makes it way harder to solve. Now, the million-dollar question, I guess, is what you ask, how do you tackle this issue? There are some ideas which I'm sympathetic to, that you have to move more and more stuff on Brussels. So since this is a session about banking legislation or banking union, I think that the move to move more and more stuff to Frankfurt is something that, at least in banking supervision, will cut the very strong links of banks with administrators and bank supervisory agencies, which I think apply to many countries of the periphery. So perhaps the EU has to take a stance that what they have been doing so far, passing a directive and then allowing for the transposition member countries, has to be much more, has to be redesigned.
Thank you. Maybe I just use the prerogative of the chair to comment on both these two last interventions. So, you know, you mentioned Estonia, and there are many countries in Eastern Europe, actually, where we have had dramatic improvements in institutional quality and in corruption. Poland, for example, also. But most of these legal changes happened before they joined the European Union. And this sovereignty argument that you have, Daniel, is about once you're in, that's the situation. before you are entering, you actually have a weaker position. Having said that, I think this was certainly in Estonia's case, and I would argue in Poland's case, driven primarily by internal forces and part of sort of a determined ambition for the political elite to clean up legislation. So very interesting to compare also Estonia and Latvia, which started more or less from the same starting point, but were very different processes that took place, and Latvia had a much more difficult time to control its corruption. So yes, I think there are possibilities to use sort of this accession to clubs to have an enforcement over corruption, but it is of course a very difficult issue. Anyhow, there were many people who wanted to ask questions. So you, and then you. So,
My name is Sigrun Davidsdottir. I'm an Icelandic journalist. I spent some time in Cyprus beginning of December. I've been writing about Cyprus and Iceland, making comparisons. It's a very, very interesting comparison. And I want to point, because you mentioned that Iceland had grown in over 15 years. It's actually the Icelandic banking system grew only for 5 years. But in these 5 years, it was from one GDP to 8 or 9. And what you were asking about, you know, can this last? No, it can't. Because when you pour money into countries like Cyprus, like Iceland, with very weak supervision, weak regulators, politicians as they are, no, it's a recipe for disaster. But that's an aside. What I wanted to ask is what I found really worrying when I was visiting, and was the lack of emphasis of actually finding out what has happened. One of the great things that Iceland did after the collapse was a thorough report of 2,600 pages. So now nobody in Iceland can say that they don't understand, that they don't know what happened. And that's what I find worryingly lacking in Cyprus. And talking about the bail-in, understanding the bail-in, I think it would be very important to understand why was there a bail-in. And it's a much longer story. I read the Anastasiades report. It's a much longer story than that it happened in just a few days. It didn't. So my question is really to you, how do you explain, you Cypriots, how do you explain that there is so little emphasis on actually finding out what happened? How on earth are you going to draw any lessons from this if it's not actually analyzed and clarified what went wrong? And then just to finish, I mean, the fact that you have corruption is so worrying, and I really hope that you get to do something about it, because it's a wonderful island that you have, and it deserves something better.
I want to collect. So one question there, and then one in the back.
Stavros Zengios from University of Cyprus. I agree with Daniel's overall comment that sudden inflow of money is a disaster waiting to happen. But I question the argument that, well, under the banking union would not have happened. And the reason I want to question is because it helps us understand that there are some fundamental Eurozone problems here to deal with than Cyprus, like Iceland, overextending themselves. You said that under SSM would have interfered earlier. The reason Cyprus had these big interest rates was mostly because they were investing in periphery bonds, especially Greece. So what would have SSM done? They would have gone around telling everybody in Cyprus, stop buying Greek government bonds because there is a risk of default. They couldn't have done it. And I don't think, well, today the ECB is doing it with Greece. The second comment is about, well, under a banking union, they would have more data and they would have stopped extending ELA to the Cyprus, like in bank. There was an opinion by the European Central Bank in May 2012 that advised the government not to recapitalize like in bank, but to resolve it. And even if they had this opinion, they continue extending ELA for another 1 year. I was an advisor to the Special Investigation Commission, so I know very well what happened. I know that all of it is top secret. So I'm teaching the Icelandic case to my students, but I cannot teach the Cyprus student case because it's top confidential. There was lots of information at the European Central Bank that there was not sufficient collateral, and the bank was insolvent. And they ignored it for political reasons, under pressure or whatever. So why would it change now? So I think the banking union is not a panacea.
Okay. Ms. Lurie.
I'm Helen Lurie. I'm professor of economics at the Athens University of Economics and Business, and I was deputy governor of the Central Bank of Greece.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Okay. I was deputy governor of the Central Bank of Greece from 2008 to 2014, responsible for monetary policy and bank resolution. So, I mean, having seen all these banks, Greek banks, of course, coming to the monetary policy part of the bank, asking for more central bank funding in the beginning and ELA later, and getting to their resolution at the end. I have this question, which it's a theoretical question, but maybe we can discuss it, which is, shouldn't the supervision, when they provide charters for new banks, have some kind of optimal number of banks in a national banking system? I mean, in Greece, at the peak of the crisis, we had 19 commercial banks, 16 cooperative banks, more than 10 foreign banks. I mean, we had too many banks. And of course, once the crisis started, we had these deposit increases, in deposit rate increases in order to attract customers, especially from the weaker banks, and all the irrelevant problems. So the question is, should supervision take into account some kind of optimal bank number in an economy and not allow any more banks to be in this economy? I mean, regulate the sector also with respect to the number. And one short comment is foreign capital, I mean, foreign banks. I've seen foreign banks, in the case of the Baltic countries, they might have had a good effect, but I've seen them, the way they behaved in the case of the Balkan countries, and I've seen my colleagues in the Bank of Albania or Bulgaria, etc., being very much upset about the withdrawal of funds back to European banks, and there are also, and even in Greece, we had the three largest foreign banks, they just left. Okay, they recapitalized their subsidiaries, they let them be absorbed by a Greek systemic bank, and then they left. So they haven't provided any help at all. And actually, I've read lots of articles in the literature, Journal of Financial Economics has many of them, that say that foreign capital may create a contagion, negative contagion effects in domestic countries, in host countries. Thank you.
Okay, who wants to come in on? Daniel?
I mean, this foreign owned banks, I think Eric knows a thing or two about them. They are no panacea either. They transmit, of course, the shocks from their home countries to your economy, and that can at times be a negative element, but they protect you usually against catastrophes, right? They don't insulate you totally. But when you're hit by a financial crisis, not by your own public sector finance crisis, that's still different. But if you're hit by a financial crisis, then foreign-owned banks provide you a protection. So the Bulgarians might have complained because in the first leg, 2008, foreign banks withdrew capital. Actually, it was good because it cooled down the Bulgarian economy and prevented them from having the same crisis as other people had. So again, there's no panacea against anything, but if you are a small country with a large banking system, then I think it's better to have them foreign-owned, because if push comes to shove, your government is not responsible for them, right? And that's why the Baltics came into the crisis with big problems, but Their public debt increased far less than other countries. And then on banking union, of course, it's no panacea. And of course, you will have problems even under banking union because Frankfurt cannot see everything. But I think it makes a difference to the degree to which these problems can balloon. I think they would not have ballooned to the same extent. What you mentioned was quite rightly that the supervisory arm has to assume that, by regulation, that Greek government bonds are riskless, right? Whereas the rest of the ECB and everything. But I think they have also learned their lesson. And they have other ways to have moral suasion. So again, it's not 0-1. It's not having no limit at all and having very tight limits. It puts the needle much more into the middle than at the one extreme where it has been right now. And the second point about which actually related is the idea that your banks are supervised by Frankfurt in future, now already, is only, I say, 60-70% true. Because Frankfurt cannot have enough supervisors to supervise all the 120 banks they have in detail. They have to rely on domestic input from domestic supervisors, which are supposed to work under instructions from Frankfurt. Some people will implement these instructions more faithfully and others less so, right? So yes, the SSM, the ECB will be much better informed and will be much, I think, more inclined to intervene, and they will have a much better picture than before, but not a complete picture.
Yeah, so this question about what happened in Cyprus, I think, it's not obvious to me that there's a lot of work actually that has been published. Almost every citizen of Cyprus has become an expert on this thing somehow. They might have a distorted view, and some of them might think that it's more the fiscal things, and others it's the banking, and others it's the foreign capital flows. I mean, they are all related. Well, the first part that I had, which was about preventing the imbalances from starting, I guess, in the paper that I had, it's more, you know, current account imbalances, housing imbalances, credit growth, you know, foreign capital flows, you know, whether it's for deposits or for tax structures. But, you know, that all those things are important. You might argue that you can, issue the confidential ELA things that were discussed between the central bank and the ECB, but I don't think that's the... I think people we can discuss later why you have that view, but it's not obvious to me that there is not, there is quite, if you do a Google mail in Cyprus, there is quite a lot of work actually on the internet. We are editing a book on that, but there's a lot of papers out there actually in different blogs. Maybe the person on the street might not only reads the press, but even the press has quite a lot of things actually on this. It became very political, of course. You can argue maybe may have an independent commission, but there were two independent commissions. Well, both were a bit politicized in the end. They were a bit politicized. Okay, you can do it better. You can do that better. But there are academic papers at least that are a bit more objective. It's not as if you have to have an independent commission by the government to figure out what happened, right? I mean, it's not the only way to do it anyway. I mean, maybe it says something that you don't do it, but on the other hand, it's not the only way to find out what's happened.
Okay, I think we have come to close. I cannot resist commenting on the foreign bank issues. I think one has to be very careful. But I think in Eastern Europe, clearly foreign banks played a very important role in both in financial development and in financial integration. So they built up these financial systems from scratch. Of course, we saw then in the crisis what happened when you don't have a framework protecting or supervising and regulating these cross-border flows, and you very clear signs of assets booms and signs of allowing, for example, foreign exchange exposure to grow very rapidly. In that regard, I think the banking union will help, and we will get to know about these things earlier. I think there is this separation between sort of national interest and central interest. It's absolutely no panacea, certainly not in what has been established so far. There are very important issues about the incentives between the center and incentives at the national level that I think has to be resolved for this system to work in the desired way. And I think we haven't made any progress on deposit insurance, and that's certainly something that has to become part of the system eventually. Well, we said, you know, and several people said that, you know, Cyprus was not a good model to discuss these issues, but I think we have learned a great deal about, you know, some very important European issues, and we have, I think, understood a little bit more. We may still need an independent commission, but I thought that these academic contributions have really shed light on some key aspects of the crisis and some key lessons. So thank you very much to the panel. Thank you.